Santa Claus sitting in a sauna by the sea, many majestic modern museums, and fantastic filling food. All this can be yours when you choose Helsinki to host the 2017 World Science Fiction Convention. Where else can you enjoy 17 hours of sunlight while exploring an 18th century island sea fortress? The home of Angry Birds and Linux is calling. Come be a part of the excitement as you enjoy all of this and the World Science Fiction Convention in 2017. Make sure to vote Helsinki in 2017. For more information on how to help Helsinki host the World Science Fiction Convention, please visit www.helsinkiin2017.org.
Danger. The emergency destruct system is now activated.
Cake and grief counseling will be available at the conclusion of the test.
She's alive! Alive!
Maybe you should put some shorts on or something if you want to keep fighting evil today.
Why not just put a stake through her heart?
She's not a vampire.
Well, you'd be surprised how many things that'll kill.
We are now seeing the beginnings of another stage of human evolution.
At last, we can retire and give up this life of crime.
You and your training wheels.
Hailing frequencies are open.
Hello, sweetie.
Commencing countdown. T-5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanti Show.
At least Tom Hardy got to remove the facial prosthetic this time.
I'm Sean.
I'm Paul.
I'm Julia.
I'm David.
I'm Jen.
And I'm Mad Mike.
And we're here to talk about, obviously, Mad Max Fury Road. Before we get into that, two quick things. First, I'd like to say thanks to Cora Bueller for helping me with the episode that just dropped, which is the German language SF panel. She helped me find a whole bunch of the names I could not find because I couldn't spell them. So thanks so much, Cora, for doing that. I really appreciate that. The other thing is, you may have noticed if you're on iTunes that the feed issue appears to be fixed. That's because I did some just wizardry to figure it out. We'll talk about the details, but I will note that at some point we're going to change the feed. We're just going to do it in a way that is going to involve nobody doing anything else except on our end. So you'll hear about that probably in the next couple months. We'll let people know, like, every episode it's happening in case everything goes horribly, horribly wrong. So, yeah, that's all I wanted to say. So we've got a lot to talk about, I think. So I suppose we should just start with you, Mike.
Do we want to do a quick summary for anybody and then throw out the spoiler wall?
I'm giving that to you, Mike. You get to tell everybody what this movie's about and then say spoiler!
All right, so Mad Max Fury Road is the fourth installment in the kind of genre-defining Mad Max series by George Miller and numerous folks. And the first film, when it and its sequel kind of got to the United States, really redefined a lot of what it took to do action storytelling, and especially like chase scenes and use of cars and action. And now 30 years after the last Mad Max film, we have a new Max, and it's almost a reboot and sort of not, and the timeline gets really wonky. So we join Max, and he has a voiceover about how the world was killed, and we join him, and then he's quickly captured, and he comes into the domain of Immortan Joe, who's this post-apocalyptic warlord with a sanctuary, and he has minions, and he has like generals, and it's a cool post-apocalyptic landscape. And we are going to be super, super spoilery. So if you have not seen the film yet, go see it. It's an astonishing visual spectacle. It is definitely worth your money to see it in the theaters. Go see it now. Okay, well, lots of spoilers. So Max gets shuttled along and he's turned into this blood bag to reinvigorate a war boy who all have half-lives because they're like irradiated. And then he gets taken out and there's a big chase sequence. And it turns out that that Charlize Theron, who is Imperator Furiosa and is super amazeballs and is a disabled lady with a prosthesis, like wrench fist. And this film is just metal as all heck. And there's just phenomenal action, and there's tons of relentless fight scenes and chase scenes. And what I want to talk about is this film as part of a glorious action storytelling renaissance. And that if we look at this film and we look at works like John Wick, and then, as I'm told, films like The Raid, there is an incredible renaissance in what can be done with visual storytelling and very specifically action. I've seen some critics complain about the film saying that it has no story, which is bollocks, because action is story. action is plot. Action is characterization. And this is in play and in effect for this entire film. Max is largely silent for big chunks of the film, but we know who he is by how he acts. Furiosa's actions speak as loud as her words. And we have, you know, these chase scenes, and there's an incredible kineticism to the way that the film is shot and edited, and the practical stunts, and every little bit is very deliberate, and the war rig itself is this inexorable force of their hope and their possibility as Furiosa and Max and all the brides are trying to escape to a better place. And I was just utterly blown away by the way that action was made as story in the film. And it, like, as an action writer and storyteller, it was both intimidating and a gigantic, like, super metal fortissimo call to action. And that's me.
Yes, to all of that. And Duke this week has mentioned a couple times after he saw the film that he doesn't think that there's a lot of character development in this film. And I had to adamantly disagree with that on numerous occasions. And I'm sorry, David, I totally interrupted you. Because of the fact that all of the character development and the storytelling is, it's written on the screen, but only in the, you know, the progress of the war machine, in the subtle sort of interactions between the characters, just physically, and, you know, facial features. It's all just, it's so beautifully done, but it's subtle, and people are raising their hands, so I'm going to let David talk.
Just seconding both what you and Mike said, it is very subtle, and also backing you up further on the whole characterization thing. We need to get into that, but just on the subject of visual storytelling that Mike brought up, I think this is a perfect case in point. As compared to, say, Weekend at Ultron's, where a 20-minute fight scene action scene feels very dull, whereas here we get a 2-hour action set piece, which is edge of the seat riveting because there are stakes and it matters. It matters a great deal. And that's so much through the visual storytelling.
I just want to issue a correction, and then I'll jump to Julia, which is, I did not say that this story does not have character development. I said that it is, its focus is not on character development as we traditionally understand it, which I will explain when I get to my section. So, on that note, Julia.
So, I saw this in the theater with a bunch of friends, and after it was over, we all kind of turned to each other and said, this was almost a silent movie. It could have been a silent movie because so much of the action really did tell a story, and I thought that was awesome.
It's actually going to be.
Yeah, that there's a news story about that. Paul, you want to jump in?
I was going to mention the news story that they're going to have a cut on the Blu-ray, which is just the music and no dialogue.
Wow, that is awesome.
I believe. And I so want it. Yes,
and black and white also.
Yeah. I still want this.
Will it have the sound effects as well?
I don't know.
Because that would be really interesting.
Does it need them?
Well, it doesn't necessarily, but I think that would also be interesting if they took the option of creating a silent film that was not traditional silent in terms of like all the dialogue and sound effects would not be there. It would just be music. But if it was the sound effects minus the dialogue, and that would be interesting. But, yeah. I don't know. Okay. So are we just jumping? Are we going
to... Let's jump to the next person, which is you, Sean.
Okay, so I'm actually changing my topic a little bit because now I have to defend myself against the spurious lies of Jen. In which she claimed falsely that I said that this film does not have character development, which is not true. It does have character development. It actually has a lot more character development than I think probably any of the Transformers films. And yet
combined,
it has 500% less dialogue. And I think that's really significant. This is a thing that bounces off what you said, Mike, that this film is primarily visually oriented. I mean, obviously it's a film, so it is visual, but all of the character elements, with some exceptions, are not issued to us through dialogue. That's not a traditional character story where we get like long dialogue sequences and those kinds of things. We see everything mediated through action and through the visuals. And so part of what I was interested in the film is the way in which we were getting character through what were basically moving picture snapshots of things that are rhetorically suggestive. So for example, we can get so much more out of the characters by what they don't tell us and the way in which they look at one another, the facial expressions, even just seeing visually what's going on. This film doesn't actually tell us much in terms of what the plot is. In terms of like literally telling us the plot, like someone doesn't sit down and go, here's the plot, buddy. But we do get to see those plot elements and we get things revealed to us through the action sequences, through things where they don't even tell us. So, I mean, like, for example, the moment at which we know what it is that Immortan Joe really is up to and all of the horrible things that he has been doing, we don't actually see those elements. They're revealed to us through sequences where characters appear. So, like, the first moment when we see all of the women. And what it doesn't tell us, it doesn't sit there and go, oh, well, all these women were basically raped by Immortan Joe. And, like, this is his man-child. And, like, all of these long dialogue sequences explaining the sequence. We don't need all of that. All we need is to see it. And we can figure it out on our own. And that's part of what I really loved about the film is so much of it is focused on telling a story visually through what's happening on screen versus just having sequences explained to us in long, just dialogue. So I'll kind of end it there, and I see, Jen, you kind of had a hand. So, Jen, go.
Well, this is one of the things that we, off a podcast on Twitter, discussed. I mean, essentially, this film is a masterclass in storytelling, which Mike kind of referred to in his portion as well, because it has no exposition whatsoever. It is all showing. It's all there on the screen, except the way that it's the most brilliant is that it's showing only by inference a lot of stuff. And I mentioned, and then I believe Saladin Ahmed mentioned at one point, the fact that this is a rated R film. George Miller had the opportunity to show a lot of violence, sexual violence. He could have thrown it out there. There could have been a ton of swearing. He chose not to put any of that in because all of it can be inferred from what happens on screen. And those things that are inferred are actually more horrifying than anything he could have shown. One of my favorite moments in the movie is actually right at the end when the war pups, the little boys, turn on the deformed son of Immortan Joe and just look at him. You have no idea what has happened to those war pups. No idea whatsoever. But that look is so telling that you can't help but go, holy crap, what have these people been doing to these children? And things like that are happening left and right.
Mike, I think you had a hand next.
Yeah, I think for all that there is a lot to the film without dialogue, I think the dialogue is incredibly dense with meaning. And that there is a ton of world building where one little bit then has great ripples. Late in the film, Max asks Nux, are you a black thumb? Meaning, can you repair an engine? So there's all this cool post-apocalyptic, kind of world building and setting inference and linguistic drift. You know, you have the mythology of Immortan Joe in The Witnessing and Valhalla, and he's kind of built this world around him, and it's all in brushstrokes, and that a little bit goes so far, both visually and verbally.
So I definitely second what Mike is saying. I think the dialogue is doing a ton of work. But one of the things that really impressed me that goes along with what Jen was talking about and what Saladin Ahmed had mentioned about there not being a lot of sexual violence shown is that the visuals that they show really hit the mark. Like there's the point where you see all of the women being milked. And that's just like horrifying, but it's only there for a second. It's not highly sexualized. And it just gives you a glimpse that, you know, this world is very wrong. There's seriously wrong stuff going on. And then when you see the wives, like the wives are wearing scantily clad, flimsy, wispy outfits. But it's clearly because they're the wives who he's keeping as his objects. And they're not objectified by the camera. So I thought that was awesome. And then you have Charlize Theron, who's like, awesome and disabled with a prosthetic arm and amazing. And then the people that she came from are these other completely different kinds of women. So I loved that this really showed you a wide scope of people in the world.
Yeah, I agree. I did really like when they first meet the women. That was really cool. The thing I did want to add, too, is, you know, Mike actually brought up that really good point, and I think it really dovetails off what I was saying, that moment when he says, like, are you a black thumb, right? If in any other kind of film, they would have spent, like, another line of dialogue explaining what he meant. But here, all he says is that thing, and then the guy goes, and he nods, and then he says, go to the engine. That's it. And we learn everything we need to know about that moment from watching him actually react. And I think that there's one other scene that I felt that if you didn't think about this film as visual rhetoric would not have worked, which is the scene at which Charlize Theron is shown like walking out into the sand and then she collapses and screams, which felt very cliche, but what I felt really worked as in terms of the visual rhetoric of the film because of the way in which it operates. It's this really dramatic, intense moment where we don't actually need to have an explanation for the event. We're getting a sort of snapshot of what's occurring. And that's another thing I really, really like. So, I probably should shut up and we should go to the next person.
Paul had his hand up.
Go, Paul.
Paul has his hand up and he's the next person. So I say he talks and then talks again.
Yeah, perfect. Go for it.
Okay, so one more thing I want to mention about the visual rhetoric is it even works for the villains as well as for the protagonists. I mean, look at Immortan Joe. The first time we get to see him, the film doesn't spend any dialogue or any backstory on what he's like, but we can see that he's old, he's dying, but he's showing himself as being buffed and muscular by that armor he's being strapped into. This is a world where image is everything. And then later, when he's lost his son-to-be and his bride, he just breaks him apart, and that scene broke me apart because you can see the anguish on him. I mean, a villain made me feel, and the film made me feel for his loss, even if it's all fucked up, pardon my language, on why he would have a son by a bride without consent, but still his visual anguish was conveyed through the film, and I was just moved by all that visual rhetoric. But what moved me even more was the cinematography of this film. This is probably the best desert movie I've seen since The English Patient, and probably better than that, and probably almost approaching A Lawrence of Arabia. I wish there was a 70mm cut of this film. I would still watch it. I mean, the gorgeous visual landscapes. The scene I want to talk about the most is the storm. We see them driving into that storm. We can't quite see how big it is. We just see this big wall thing. And then the camera pulls back to see all the vehicles, those tiny little things, and that huge giant dust form. You're thinking, oh, fuck, this thing is huge. It is just so gorgeous. It's going to make me cry. And you could have had 2 hours of just visual deserts, and most of this is desert, but we get so much more. We get the Citadel, which, George Miller has clearly learned and remembered from creating a world from back in Thunderdome, and the Citadel looks like a weird, strange place with all sorts of, you see the guys walking on the water wheels, and they're going in perfect synchronicity. We see the lips. The camera shows us everything, and then every so often the camera will show us night scenes, and the palette of the movie completely changes into this dark, somber mood. And then there's the scenes in the mud, and the palette changes again. This is just visual cinematography. I came in expecting the action, and the action is filmed gorgeously. I mean, I kind of gasped when we saw the pole vault, or I saw the pole vaulter. It was like, oh my God, they can't be showing this, and they show it. But it's just, even just the landscapes, just watching this thing, I could turn off the sound and just look at this thing all day long. It's just such gorgeous. Okay. People can talk, I believe.
I think I have my hand up first. I just wanted to add, sure, Paul, because like this film does do a really good job with scenes where they're using the zoom out function. So the scene you described, right, is gorgeous. When they first see that storm and it's the music and everything. It is almost like a cosmic event or a sort of divine event. It's beautiful. But the same thing happens when we first see the Polecats, these crazy guys swinging back and forth on these like flexible pole things so that they can jump onto the truck and retake it. But we see it, we see them, and then it zooms out, like showing the whole like sea of things. I mean, this film is shot beautifully. It is an action film that is gorgeous, and it is a film that even I saw it twice, and even on a second viewing, like it's just as amazing. It doesn't stop being amazing at any point. It just gets gorgeous and gorgeous the more you watch it, I feel. So, Jen, I think you had your hand after me, so go ahead.
Yeah, I have to totally agree with the fact that it literally did just, it became more gorgeous the second time. And actually, the dialogue for me, because one of the things that usually is a problem for action films, and it was for this one too, is that dialogue tends to be still on a lower volume. So on a second viewing, I actually got more of the dialogue and realized how much richer it was that second time. But one of the things that I realized in the second viewing as well is the first time you're kind of distracted by the action. The second time you're slightly less distracted by it because you're so caught up in it that you can focus slightly more on the details. There are so many details in this movie in terms of the visual, and this goes back to the visual story. There are so many details. The skulls everywhere is amazing. I mean, there's actual physical skulls on the war rig. There's this ceiling that has this skull motif, the tattoos that are on Morton Joe's, you know, belongings, all of it's there. And I really like, I want to see this. I want a giant theater so I can pause it halfway through a scene and just stare at it for 10 minutes at a time, exploring all the little things that he put into it. But the reason that I wanted to actually specifically come off of Paul's statements is because there's my idea of the romantic. This is a romantic thing. And I'm going to cut in here really quick just to say that part of the reason that I view it as a romantic film is because of the use of the scenery. It literally evokes old romantic paintings, which was one of the things that I just found so absolutely powerful of it. It's actually the storm is almost an identical look to a piece of romantic painting that David went and found, and it's glorious. So I just wanted to throw that in there. I stopped.
I wanted to loop around again a little bit through cinematography to the fact that they use more medium and wide shots to shoot fighting, and that they trust the performers, they trust the choreographers. They don't do the thing that terrible American action movies do, where they cut on impact, where the moment of impact is used as a cut, and I hate that. And I love that in this film, they trusted the performers, they trusted the choreography, and that it was allowed, you could see it all unfold.
Yeah, Rachel just, she just mentioned the fact that it's edited unlike much any other action film, and that's partially because George Miller's wife, whose name I cannot recall right this second, is the one that edited the film, and she's never edited an action film. A lot of people, when I saw, when I saw a lot of critics complaining about how frenetic the action was, and I was like, this was the least frenetic action film that I've seen in a really long time. And Mike's just letting me know that it's Margaret Sixel. Is George Miller's wife, and obviously beautifully cut film.
Okay, I totally agree. And I happen to be next in line, so I'm going to, this all segues really well into my topic, which in all caps I wrote, guitar! ! This is shorthand for the fact that all of the effects in this movie are practical, and I love that. I feel like CGI gets used way too heavily in most modern action movies, and this, one of the reasons why the action was so awesome and engaging and engrossing and beautiful was because it was real people and real props all the time, including the giant 120-pound flame-throwing guitar. That guitar, there's this one war vehicle with amps all over the front of it and speakers, and this guy who is like hooked up to wires and playing this giant guitar that shoots flames out of the neck. And it's a real guitar. It's a real practical guitar that weighs 120 pounds. And you actually, he was actually literally shooting fire out of it during the filming, which was a mechanism on the whammy bar that would make that happen. But like, there's an interview I saw with him on BuzzFeed where he talked about how he'd always dreamed of being in a Mad Max film. So this was like a dream job for him. And that like he just basically got to hang out the entire time that they were filming and play this guitar, which didn't make very good sound, but he didn't care. He was just jamming. And I was like, that is awesome, because how cool is it that your dream job gets to be that and you get to do it? But that just combined with all of the... Jen was talking about the details of all the skulls. I love that too. There's so much visually going on, and that's extra highlighted by the fact that everything you're seeing is real physical objects.
Julie, did you mention the guitar man's name?
He's a rock star from Australia named Iota. And that's lowercase I, capital O-T-A.
Yeah, his real name is Sean Hape. And apparently he's been like, I read an article, he said he's formed his first band at 16, and he's just been like jamming for like forever.
He's been in a number of films too.
Yeah, I mean, and if you listen to his songs, I'll put the article, it was on Business Insider, but like, he's really good. His music.
Yeah, there are actually several articles out on the internet right now, so if you Google Mad Max guitar player, a bunch of them will come up. The one I happened to read first was on BuzzFeed.
Yeah.
Which is where he talks about it being his dream job.
And the other quick point I did want to make, that I thought was really interesting, the people on Film Spotting mentioned this about the music, and I didn't realize it because I thought the guitar was, like, he was playing it and then they mapped it over the soundtrack, but it's actually part of the soundtrack. And so it's deliberately shot so that when they go to the guitar guy, it's so that we hear the guitar in the soundtrack. Which is really interesting because I didn't know that until the second time I went and saw it, and you could actually feel it's almost like he's becomes a character that's within the story. He has his own sort of like theme, and so every time the camera zooms in on him, we hear that guitar come out. It's really fascinating, and it does, yeah. But anyway, I'll shut up. I think, Jen, did you want to go next, talk about Guitar Guy?
Well, I just wanted to say that, you know, the speakers did work, and Julia mentioned this, but part of the reason that it was such a cool sort of addition, somebody was telling me, can somebody Google doof real quick? Because it has a meaning. There's a reason for the guitar player's name, you know, and he's the one leading the charge, which is just so amazing that Morton Joe has created this, like the whole idea of the Morton Joe's religion and everything, and the fact that he carries around the drums and the guitar to lead the charge is just so cool.
So according to Urban Dictionary, a doof is a huge sound system up to 10,000 watts. So he's the doof warrior, which makes sense.
Perfect.
Amazing.
Yeah.
He has so many speakers. Oh my god, he did. He had like almost 100 speakers on that damn thing.
Yeah, and he's like held up by wires, so that, and the
bungee cords. Yeah,
the guitar is too, so that he can't carry that whole guitar all the time. And he says in the BuzzFeed interview that like, if he flipped the right way, it was almost like laying in a hammock. So he spent a lot of time on set doing that. And there's actually a part in the film where you can see him just kind of chilling hammock style.
I remember that. Like, he's, like, sleeping. Kind of cute.
That's because in reality, like, filming takes a long time, and he would just totally take a nap.
That is super cool. That's great. Jen?
Yeah, and I'm just saying, everybody should go look up the guy who created the cars on this film, because every single one of the vehicles is fully functioning. They made something like 160 cars. There's 80, actually, in the movie. All of them totally functional vehicles, all of them completely insane and totally freaking awesome, including the doof's vehicle, which is a giant speaker drum system that moves, and I want to own it. And then what is the bullet farmer's his car called, the tank, which is just
with the treads.
God, you know, really, this, it's such such an amazingly beautiful piece of filmmaking in every respect. And I want all the cars, I just got to say.
How many cars do you think they actually blew up in this movie?
It's a lot. A lot. A lot.
It's probably like 50, 60 cars. It just feels like so many things blow up or are wrecked in some way. It's kind of freaking awesome.
Yeah, the guy's name was Colin Gibson, was the production designer. And yeah, it's just absolutely brilliant.
Well, excellent. So our next person...
David.
Which I believe David. So David, go.
Well, I wanted to talk about the film as a poem. Poetry is notoriously resistant to definition, but one of the ones I've found most useful is poetry as a concentrated form of literary expression. And I think visually, a lot of what the rest of you have brought up, I think, very much tie into that, right? Just how dense it is in terms of images and that kind of storytelling. But I think so it is a visual poem, but also at the level of the script, it is a very concise script, right? It makes sense for it to be a silent film. There's not that much dialogue compared to your average film, but what there is there counts, even in the way that we mishear or partly hear it. So much of the dialogue we get is through fragments, but very meaningful ones. So a lot of Splendid's dialogue. So we hear it as kind of voiceover, even when she's standing right there, or when Furiosa is finding out what happened to the green land that she was taking everyone to, and we have everybody standing around her, and we're hearing the dialogue, but their lips aren't moving. Right, but we're hearing their voices, so it's becoming the language is being used very musically there. But all these fragments that are very meaningful. And if we look at Max's dialogue, and it is very much part of his arc of redemption, so that when we first meet him, he's completely feral, and his opening voiceover, that the only thing that matters is survival, well, that is what he's going to have to learn is wrong by the end of the film. And so we begin with his language, his words being incomprehensible or just extremely fragmentary when he first meets Furiosa and the bride. He's very animalistic, and he's speaking virtually in grunts, and he gives no answer to his name. Well, by the end, he's becoming more and more articulate, and his climax, right? He knows how he, in a radical move for an action film, is not the one who kills the final boss. That's Furiosa, right? Which is completing her arc. For Max, his arc is a reintegration into language, an act of healing, which a completely selfless act of healing, which is again very radical for an action movie hero, and his language at that point is entirely the language of empathy. I'm sorry. Yes. So understanding that this is very hurtful, but he's giving everything to help her at this point. So the use of language in the film is extremely effective, I think, and in its very fragmentary nature, massively important.
That's all really interesting, and I did think it really fascinating with the way in which it ends. Is for her, it's a return to the place she was trying to escape, and for him, it's once more him leaving. They part ways, and so they have.
But he's human again. He's not an animal anymore.
Right. I think what's fascinating about that is that we're getting one is a return, and one is a different. I guess you could say a different form of return, but which itself necessitates him leaving. He's presumably going back on the road. So we have these very divergent endings, which I thought was really, really interesting. But yeah, so.
Mike?
So I would be, I'll be cheeky enough to volunteer a reading of the film that posits Max as a stand-in for most action storytelling, and that this film and this story as it's told kind of brings him out of incoherence and kind of almost misanthropy in a general fashion, and presents a stronger alternative and rehabilitates the character so that he comes out of the wilderness of meaningless, you know, sound and fury signifying nothing, and he ends up as the Wanderer again.
But it's also that reintegration, that moving him from a system also seems to be the kind of removing him from the most toxic form of patriarchal capitalism, right? That is now in its end game is this, right? And so the where we hear language being used well and with a real sort of beauty and density is with the women in the film.
That is interesting, and I know Jen's going to want to talk about some of that, David.
Oh, sorry, Jen.
No, go ahead.
Yeah, I think that's great. I did think it was interesting, and I wonder, David, how you kind of read this, because when I saw it the other night with my friend, we got to the end, and we both kind of realized that he's kind of the conduit through which the stories are being mediated, that it's not necessarily Mad Max story, it's the stuff that's happening around him. And I'm curious, David, how you kind of read that.
I'm not sure about that, because I agree that he's not central, but it's maybe a more ensemble piece. I mean, if you look at the name of the film, Furiosa's name is in the title.
Yeah.
There's almost a signal there. And the things that are, we could talk about the things that are going on around them, but if you look at what happens with the film, everybody has an arc, right? And the arcs all intersect and affect each other. So his arc of, he and Furiosa are the ones who need redemption. And theirs intertwine. And you know, one supports the other. And so I don't see it necessarily as being sidelined, in that each person that we see in this film is the protagonist of their own story. And that would include Max. It's just that the part of the story that the film is telling also is one that moves away, that necessarily moves away from that figure as the driving force of the plot and the very center of the tale.
So one of the things, and I have not been able to track down the review again, unfortunately, because I thought it was fantastic, but one of the ideas, and it kind of ties along with the idea that Mad Max is a conduit, was that just Mad Max is a witness to other people's stories. And at least after the first one, and the first one, he's definitely, part of the story. But in Road Warrior and, Thunderdome, and then this one, it's more everybody else's story. And he is kind of along for the ride. Where, as you said, he's the one through which we see everybody else's stories. My dad called him a catalyst, which I thought was a really interesting sort of idea. But the reason I raised my hand now is that all of this, and David and I kind of talked about it, and I'm not an expert on romanticism by any stretch of the imagination, but I was driving home the other day and I was like, you know, I was thinking about it and how big it is, and but how dark and how with how the grotesque plays into everything, that in a sense this is a romantic film, but in the sort of classical sense of romanticism. And Mad Max himself, and both Mad Max and Furiosa are romantic heroes, in that, you know, they're outside the structure of civilization, Mad Max specifically, less so Furiosa. But they still have sort of the sense of power. This is a direct quote from Wikipedia. A sense of power, often leadership, the society has impoverished itself by rejecting, which I just thought was really interesting. And sort of the triumph of the individual, which by the end he has triumphed, but not necessarily against everything else, which I thought was interesting. The problem with this movie is that there are so many themes that, you know, I sit here going, I want to talk about everything all at the same time, which I can't do. But I did want to specifically point out that I believe this film, and I wish China Mieville was here so he could back me up on all this, is specifically anti-capitalist, as David mentioned. People like to sit there going, you know, it's a very feminist film, which I do absolutely fundamentally believe. It is probably the most feminist action movie that I have seen personally. But I think it goes beyond that to be a rejection of both complete female power, so it's actually anti-matriarchy and anti-patriarchy. And in that sense, is where it becomes feminist, because it's much more about equalizing the two sides than it is necessarily about having one dominating over the other. The reason I say it's anti-matriarchy is that both societies are failing within this film. Immortan Joes is obviously not doing particularly well. The Half-Lives, who are the war boys, they require blood transfusions just to survive because of radiation poisoning. He's breeding through the women, but usually they're not viable children because his society is literally dying off. On the other side, you have the Vuvalina, the most badass biker gang in the history of biker gangs, who are also not particularly succeeding. They are wandering the desert. They are dying off. The youngest one is probably in her late 30s, early 40s, or it seems to be. They are not having children either. Neither one is successful. It requires a balancing of the two things. And that balance is really specifically shown in the interactions between Mad Max and Furiosa. I was completely blown away by so many things in this film that I could literally spend an hour squeeing. So I'm going to stop, and hopefully somebody else has something to say.
We are not things.
As Mike just pointed out, we are not things. Julia?
So I totally agree with your point that they really do need the balance of both societies, and that the society that where the women were, it wasn't lasting either. And that partly was because the world was so messed up and the environment had gone away. But if you don't have men, then you can't breed. So that's a fair point. I think that I definitely agree with you about Furiosa and Mad Max both being romantic heroes, and that really you get to see their characters develop in tandem, and they mm-hmm. influence each other, and that makes the character development happen. So you get to see sort of like Furiosa's shell come down at the point where she gets to the desert and she breaks down because it's just like, what is going to happen? And then she sort of tries to go back to her tough image, and she's like, okay, well, we're just going to go right across the salt flats forever. And Max is at that point also crucially, and this is like deep into spoiler territory for anybody who hasn't seen the movie, but we did warn you. Max at that point is totally ready to just wander off and not have his character fully develop. And then he actually has his moment, which is influenced by watching her have her moment. And he goes after her and is like, no, you know, he rejects his wandering. And he's like, I've got to actually help these people. And I've got to have compassion for them and tell them that the only way they're going to fix this is by going back there and retaking it. And then she has to say, you're right. And that's hard for her. And so that, like, that exchange is so amazing because it's both of them letting their guards down enough to trust each other. And that's the crux of that. Men and women have to work together to make things happen. And we do actually have to trust each other, not just for the brief moment where we maybe can forge an alliance against a common enemy, but to work together to build something more healthy.
I just wanted to further to Jen's romanticism. The painting that she mentioned earlier is Turner's Snowstorm, which looks almost exactly the same in terms of composition to the big panoramic shot of the dust storm. But also in conjunction with our romantic heroes, Immortan Joe is a pretty good gothic hero villain. Somebody who is powerful, there's a lot of decay, who imprisons the characters, controls them economically as well as physically. He even has his gothic castle. I don't want to push the character types too far, but the traces I think are there too.
Definitely. And, you know, like to me, what this had a lot of in terms of the romanticism, is that the awe in the face of things that are terrifying. And you know, obviously as a viewer of a film, the pleasure in the grotesque and the terrifying, Sort of that connection to the sublime. And I just was, yeah, I had to talk about it in some way, shape, or form. Go ahead, Sean.
Well, Jen, as your friend, I just have to tell you that I disagree with everything you say.
I know.
But I love you.
I know.
But a question for you, because this film does a lot of really, what for me was really unexpected, the whole Valhalla element of it,
yeah.
This very overtly religious quality.
Yes.
And I'm curious in the context of your kind of argument, how do you place that kind of very overt, very almost fanatic religiosity?
Okay, so I would say that religion, in terms of fanaticism, religious fanaticism is a byproduct of capitalism gone, you know, horribly wrong. They are things, they are nameless things, and they exist only to do something for the person who has established this, you know, system. In this case, it's Morton Joe. The religion is specifically created for his purpose. And his purpose is, you know, control. And he controls through access to water and mother's milk and probably even women to an extent. So I would say that that's how it sort of fits in there.
All right, that's fair. Okay. I was just curious. It was a very interesting element, I thought. So the religious element. And I thought it played out really well. I thought it was going to be really kind of ridiculous. As soon as he said Valhalla the first time, I was like, this is going to be stupid. But it actually, I thought, felt really, really... it felt like it really worked in terms of like the our character, the guy who played the Beast. Oh, bloody hell. What was the name of the actor? Oh, I've forgotten. But Nux, the guy who plays Nux in the film, I mean, he has this very interesting religious development throughout the film. He starts as being this fanatic follower, and then he sort of changes. He becomes a different sort of fanatic follower. In fact, what I thought was interesting is that he wants to kill himself in the service of Immortan Joe in the beginning, and in the end, he actually sacrifices himself for Furiosa and Mad Max, etc. It's sort of, he's fulfilling the same religious idea, but yet doing it for a different cause, which I think will give people a lot to think about when they start writing essays on this topic.
Yes, thank you for specifically mentioning that, because it's still, as Capable suggests, it's his Manifest Destiny. Manifest Destiny has the most, you know, incredibly religious overtones. So Nux is trading one religion of sorts for another. But it's been really interesting seeing the people who believe that Nux actually has the largest character arc of all the people in the movie. And I'm just throwing that out there as an interesting idea.
Well, it's the whole heel face turn thing. I mean, he starts as the bad guy. He wants to die in the service of Morton Joe so he can go to Valhalla, and he learns better. So it's radical. I mean, in the end, he sacrifices himself so that the others can escape out the canyon. So it's a radical change, and he's not doing it because he's going to Valhalla. He's doing it because he's doing it for them and for himself. That's huge.
Except that he still says witness.
Yeah,
I would argue that he's not completely given up.
I don't know if it's as radical. I think it only appears radical because we're already inclined to think of the people he's sacrificing himself for are the good guys. But really his change is he's really only changing from one thing that requires self-sacrifice for another thing which... He believes requires self-sacrifice, although I think it's important to note that they don't explicitly ask him for it, versus Immortan Joe, who does, which I think is a pretty interesting distinction to make, that there is a difference between the way in which sacrifice is being recalled. He makes the choice for sacrifice when he's with Furiosa, etc., but yeah. But in any case, we probably should wrap up because we're getting a bit long. So maybe in really briefly, each person just say a couple like favorite thing they liked about the movie and then grade the film and then we can close out. Does that sound right for everybody? Awesome. Well, we'll start with you, Paul, because you're the first on my screen.
Okay, so I've already mentioned my favorite scene in the movie is the dust storm. I just saw a print of what inspired it, a snowstorm of hot hell while crossing the Alps, and that's actually has resonance as well, because they are trying to escape the rest, and it is devastating to the truck and to the people, and it's just one of the most gorgeous things I've ever seen on a screen in desert or anything else, to have them come across that storm and then just see that storm and then hit that storm. I was just blown away there. The movie had already sold me by then, but I was completely sold when that storm appeared.
Your grade?
I'm going to give it an A+, because this is the best movie I've seen this year. So I'm overgrading again. Sue me.
It's not an overgrade. If that's how you feel, it's fair.
Yep.
So, Julia?
It's really hard to choose a favorite, but the thing that I was thinking about right now is the point at which Max wanders off and comes back and throws a boot to Nux, because I thought that was great. He was missing his boot. It's just like the little point where he's like, okay, I'm going to trust you. Here's your boot. But I also love the fact that Charlize Theron is actually putting oil on her face, and that's how she gets her black face. That was awesome. I like the fact where you see the practical application of the makeup that she's wearing. But I will give this movie an A. I don't want to give it an A+ solely because, even though I think the appearance of the storm cloud was amazing when it first appeared on the horizon, I actually had to cover my eyes for the whole point where they were inside the dust cloud, because it was migraine central. So like I could not watch that scene in the movie. And since that was probably a good 5 minutes that I couldn't watch, I can't give it an A+.
Bummer.
That's happened before, Julia,
lots of movies are migraine triggers, and I have to like be careful. But I really wish I could have seen what happened in that cloud, and I never will.
Stuff blows up. Some people go for a little bit of a flight, but they end up okay in the end, and they walk away.
Good to know.
I'm lying. They don't walk away. Anyway, David.
Really hard for me to pick a favorite scene. In fact, the film is so much of a piece. I think I'll just mention one little grace note that I really, really loved was that brief vision of these stilt walkers in the mire. Yeah. And that's another example of just the surreal beauty of the film. It's not explained. It's just, here's the thing. Isn't this amazing? And we move on. So I love that. I'm going to go with Paul. I'm giving this an A+. The film just so perfectly achieves everything it sets out to do. It's so dense, so meaningful. I'll be astonished if I see a better movie this year.
Wow. Woohoo. Fair enough. All right, Jen.
Okay, so my favorite scene is when Angarad the Splendid, the wife of Immortan Joe, uses her pregnant body to shield Furiosa. It is one of the most powerful images in the entire film. And specifically in, you know, sort of got women as powerful. It was beautiful. It brought tears to my eyes. I was totally blown away because I was totally not expecting it. And then super briefly, the very, very end, when the milk givers released the water for the masses below, was stunning. And again, totally unexpected and just beautifully wrapped into the film. And so I have to give it an extra double million pluses. My daughter is now planning on dressing up as Furiosa as her cosplay character. She watched this film twice. We will probably watch this 1,000 more times. He gave my children, my daughters, somebody to look up to in an action film. And that's amazing. That
is awesome.
So much. Yeah.
I want to see pictures of your daughter's cosplay.
Oh my God, I'm so looking forward to it. I'm going to probably dress up as one of the other Vivalina, just so I can back her up. Because they're so amazing.
You should go as like a gender swapped Mad Max.
I could also do that.
You would be badass. I guess it would be Mad Maxi?
Mad Maxi.
Mad Maxine.
Maxine.
Mad Maxi, that is... Isn't that an actual, like, feminine product?
I think Maxie is.
Oh, wait, that's a maxi pad. Sorry.
Yeah, which is why we went to Maxine. So you can go as Mad Maxine.
Mad maxi pad. Sorry.
Oh, dear.
And we have just gone down the toilet.
Off the rails! Mike!
All right, Mike, go.
So I'm going to have to go with the final fight between Furiosa and Immortan Joe. She is wounded. She's bleeding out. She has come so far. She crawls across the cars, gets up beside Immortan Joe, and then in a moment that I cannot help but imagine as incredibly laden with meaning, she uses the prosthesis that I can only imagine that she created to serve him and to serve his empire. She uses that prosthesis to undo him and then discards it because she does not need it anymore.
Yeah.
A++ career goal action storytelling would see forever.
Yes.
Does she discard it or does it get ripped off? I thought it got ripped off.
Well, yeah, it's gone. Same thing. Doesn't need it.
She does it on purpose.
I thought it got ripped off.
No, she says, remember me, and hurls it into the gears of the wheel, doesn't she?
She hurls one of those spear things.
Attached to her hand, she is discarding it. She is specifically using her arm as the weapon of his destruction.
Huh. I'll have to watch it again. I didn't catch that. But
she turns the tool that she used to serve him into the device of his doom.
Yep, and says, remember me.
Yeah, take that, Immortan Joe.
Glorious. Glorious!
Yeah. My final thought, I don't have a favorite scene. I would just say that I love the fact that this movie was completely crazy balls the whole time. And it just kept getting increasingly more just... It just basically, like, they went into a room one day and they're like, what completely insane stuff could we possibly do? Like, what weird stuff can we put on cars? Like, yeah, pole vaulting dudes on giant, like, yeah, that's fine. Let's do that. Let's put spikes on cars. Like, yeah, any of that. Go for it. I loved all of that because it was so fun to just see how increasingly wild it would get. So, I will give this film an A+, and I'm giving it an A+ primarily because of what Jen said about her daughter.
If that's the only reason you're giving it an A+, that is not the only reason to give this movie an A+.
That is a reason why I'm taking. So you can eat that all you want. I'm giving it an A+. It's a great film. I think everybody should go see it. And Jen, you can have one last thing.
I will say that one of the greatest things about Mad Max Fury Road is the fact that it really pissed off men's rights activists.
Aww.
Therefore, this deserves more A+s than I can ever give a movie.
Who are complaining about it being ruining a piece of American culture? And
oh, I love that. Like, oh, honey. Oh, honey. You don't even know how to use Google.
And I just want to say that if any of you watched The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, someone made an amazing, amazing video of the Kimmy Schmidt theme song with clips from Fury Road, and it is awesome. It's The Unbreakable Imperator Furiosa. Google it. It's so great.
That is wonderful. Well, it looks like we all just basically loved the pants off of this. So if you've not seen Mad Max Fury Road, you should go see it. All of us would agree that you should definitely see it. And then you should see it 900 more times. Unless you can't afford 900 times. And then maybe, just twice, at least?
Yeah, at least twice.
At least twice. Cool. I would maybe caution against taking your young children, although Jen's kids are teens, fine. So I guess that's okay. But your kids, probably, you would have taken them when they were like 3.
Yeah, probably.
It is really violent, and it does have some really disturbing things. So if you're someone who's sensitive to gore and violence that looks like it hurts a lot, that's something to consider. Like, you can close your eyes, but there are some ow moments.
That's fair. Yeah, it's a pretty violent film.
Like, I would say that's why it's got the rated R.
It is specifically why it has the rated the R rating. It's just intense violence. It's not even particularly gory violence. There's only one piece of gore that I can even remember, and that's at the very end. There's not a lot of blood, but it is very intense violence. So,
yeah, I mean, people get blown up a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whatever.
There's a lot of human barbecue.
So good. Go watch the movie. Thank you for joining us.
All right, guys. Well, thanks for everybody for joining us. Do leave your comments on the blog at skiffingfanny.com or send us a tweet at skiffingfanny. If you saw the movie, you've got a thing to say. So on that note, thanks, everybody, and awkward ending and scene. If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
This is Ripley. Last survivor of the Nostromo. Signing off.